Pseudopod episode 119, 5th December 2008. This week's story, Pran's Confession by Joel Arnold. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from a long-term Pseudopod alumni, the magnificent Mr. Joel Arnold. Joel's work has appeared in Weird Tales and Cheezine as well as here, and this story was first published on Gothic.net back in 2004, which seems far longer ago than 4 years, doesn't it? For those of you with birthdays in February, or who know people who have birthdays in February, he has a collection of sci-fi horror due out that month from the excellent Sam's Dot Publishing. So do a loved one a favour and scare the bejesus out of them with it. In the meantime, why not pull your cap down and prepare to accept a very, very troubling confession? Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Pran's Confession by Joel Arnold. The young men in Bangkok sometimes called him Grandpa or Uncle as he clutched their lithe, oiled bodies. His fingers grasped a bit too tight. His nails dug into their skin and drew beads of blood. Sometimes he'd choke them, but never enough to kill them. He had to be careful. He was gaining a reputation among them, and a reputation was something he had to stay away from. But it was hard not to let the old feelings overcome him, the memories flooding into his mind of how it once felt to watch a life quickly fade behind the suffocating film of a plastic bag. Somnong startled, he clutched frantically at his shirt pocket. The piece of paper was still there. It was a long, tedious train ride from the Thai border in the northwest to the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh. He slept most of the way, getting out to stretch at Batam Bang and again at Persat, where he ate a quick meal of fish soup. He fell back into another short, fitful nap, hard to sleep because of the dreams, his dreams of Pran. There were other dreams, too, other nightmares of those times. Dreams of Doik, the prison's director, his parchment-like face, teeth too big for his mouth, his death-like smile. How could one not have nightmares about him? But it was Pran who coaxed Somnong back to prison S-21, not the nightmares of the beatings, the beheadings, the children in black peasant garb with red scarves, suffocating men and women with clear plastic bags, men and women who could have been their parents. No. It was the simple dreams of Pran whispering to him in a voice worn down from days of screaming. You took my soul. The train pulled into the Phnom Penh train station. Somnong got off with a small backpack. He pulled his New York Mets cap down low on his forehead and looked out over the waters of Bangkok. Tendrils of dawn reached out over the lake's surface, revealing the shapes of small boats and early risen fishermen setting out their nets. He felt for the piece of paper, folded in his shirt pocket, rubbed his fingers absently over the tiny protrusion it made against the shirt's fabric. A tremor ran along his arm up to his shoulder. His tongue felt dry. He wanted to lie down here as the sun rose, shut his eyes to the sound of the cormorants and egrets, and sleep for 100 years. But he knew if he did that now, Pran would continue to come to him in his sleep, plead to him forever. My soul. He turned in a circle to work out the painful cramps in his calves, then found a cyclo and driver to take him south down the city streets and boulevards. He recognized many of the buildings, the monuments, the roads. Yet something had dramatically changed in his absence. What was it? In the markets, vendors busied themselves over colorful displays of fruits and vegetables and the silver bullet shape of fresh fish. Monks shuffled past in bright saffron robes. Children with outstretched hands implored him to toss them spare change. So many people bustling about in the warm morning air. So many people. That was it. The people. They moved about freely now, and there were so many of them, not like the days of the Khmer Rouge, when the city had been emptied of nearly everyone, its citizens forced to the outlying hills and labor camps. They'd been promised peace, but were given nothing but violence and death. Now the city thrived, but the urging of the dead kept Somnong moving. He closed his eyes and tried to sleep as the wheels of the cyclo whirred over fresh blacktop. Was that the only reason he came? To put a continuing dream to rest? To give peace to just one of many souls that begged for justice? Surely there were other reasons. He awoke when the cyclo driver braked to a squeaky stop. There it was, the prison. Now it was a museum, the Tool Slang Museum, a testament to the atrocities of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. Back then, it was referred to simply as Security Prison 21, S-21. Sam Nung tipped the cyclo driver and stood alone outside the gate, reading the old red sign. Fortify the spirit of the revolution. Be on your guard against the strategy and tactics of the enemy so as to defend the country, the people, and the party. The words chilled him. Was I such a monster? Sam Nung kept his sunglasses on and his Mets cap pulled low. Would anyone recognize him after all these years? Most of the ones who'd feared him were killed long ago, and besides, his hair was mostly gone now, the rest of it wisps of bone white. His skin was creased with age, and there were scars on his neck and face, where dozens of black, cancerous moles had been removed. He nodded at the guard standing casually at the museum's entrance and stepped into the compound. For one dizzying moment, he felt as if he'd never left, as if his years in Bangkok were nothing but a sweet, vivid dream. Phantom smells of sweat, blood, and feces invaded his nostrils. My uniform. Where's my uniform? He'd be punished without his uniform. And Doik, he sensed him in the walls, felt that he'd step around a corner at any moment with his donkey teeth, guards on either side. One nod and the guards would descend upon Sam Nung with hard black batons. The sound of children playing on the grounds of the compound snapped him back to reality. Before this was a prison, it was a school. Funny how things have come full circle. Children again play on the open field. How many have I watched die here? Do these children know the ground they now play on is saturated with the blood of human slaughter? Sam Nung swept back thin strands of hair and tucked them back up into his cap. He walked into one of the buildings. Prison cells that had once been classrooms. You will write your confession now. Sam Nung gasped as he peered into one of the cells. Black and white photographs covered the walls from floor to ceiling, mugshots that Sam Nung himself had taken. There were hundreds of them, thousands. Every room that he passed was full of them, photographs of the prisoners who lived and died here. Doomed faces, blank eyes, unsmiling mouths. They continued to look at Sam Nung as they did all those years ago. This one died easily. And here, she hung herself with her trousers. And this one, and here, taken out to Chowung Ik, the killing fields. And this boy here begged for his mother. So many of them crowding around him, how could he remember them all? Over 17,000 prisoners. Only 7 survived. He felt once again for the paper folded neatly in his pocket. He searched for Prawn's face among the photographs on the walls. So many. So many. The light from their eyes lost as they stare at the camera, their wills smashed. It's as if they are already dead. Why this obsession with documentation? Doik was meticulous about keeping records. His red-inked notations peppered many of the confessions. It was as if the Khmer Rouge wanted to leave behind proof of their cruelty. Another room full of pictures, more familiar faces. Sam Nung remembered how dazed they were, their blindfolds freshly removed, beatings freshly stopped. His own diatribes halted as he asked them to look at the camera lens. Doik would tell them to smile. He'd laugh at his own joke, his tongue waving behind ghost-white teeth. But the prisoners never smiled. How long ago had it been? 25 years? His index finger twitched at the phantom memory of taking Prawn's photograph. Placid face, darkly tanned, his prisoner number, 10572, stitched on his tattered shirt. Prawn squinted. Poor eyesight. Owl-like circles of light skin where the frames of glasses once set. Glasses were a sign of an educated man. The welts and scars on his hands were fresh, probably inflicted by Prawn himself to make him appear like a simple farmer from the hills. A farmer, a peasant, a friend of Unka would have no need of glasses, no need for smooth, soft hands. And Unka had no need for educated men. Unka, the central party of the Khmer Rouge. They wanted the farmers, men from the hills, whose minds were free of education, whose minds were blank slates that could easily be filled. You will write your confession now, Prawn. Iron manacles, big enough for oxen, restrained Prawn's legs. His hands were tied behind him with wire, and a heavy chain connected them to the manacles. Who is Anka? Samnang flexed the fingers of his right hand. Anka is your new family. He squatted in front of Prawn, lifted his head up by the hair so that he could look into his eyes. Anka is your mother and father. Anka is all you need. He let go of Prawn's hair and brought his right fist quickly forward, connecting with Prawn's nose in one dizzying instant. Samnang felt the small bones break, felt a fresh burst of blood on his knuckles. He stepped back and flung it off his fingers. Prawn breathed heavily through his mouth as he looked up at Samnang, eyes squinting, jaw quivering with pain. Anka doesn't have time for your games, Samnang said. You will give your confession now. Another man sat in a chair in the corner, poised over a pad of paper, ready to capture Prawn's words and regurgitate them in ink. Why should I trust you? Prawn strained to get the words out. How do I know what I tell you is what gets written? You think too much. Samnang lit a cigarette, inhaled, and blew a cloud of bluish smoke in Prawn's face. Now, he said. He brought the glowing end of the cigarette close to Prawn's left eye. Prawn's eyelid fluttered. Tiny pink bubbles formed on his lips as he panted. Please, okay, my confession. Here is my confession. You write it down like I say, yes? Then I confess. Samnang backed away and took another long drag from the cigarette. He nodded. Of course. Prawn rubbed his cheeks against his shoulders as best he could to wipe away some of the sweat and tears. I am a teacher, Prawn said. A teacher of history. Why is that so dangerous? Samnang said nothing. He waited patiently. The man taking notes looked up eagerly from his pad. Prawn looked down at the floor and ran his tongue gingerly over his swollen lips. You say there is no family but Anka. You say there is no love but the love of Anka. But an idea cannot be a family. A set of principles cannot be love. Prawn looked up. I love life. That is my crime in your eyes. Samnang flexed his fingers again, curled them into a tight ball. He took a step toward Prawn and raised his fist to strike. Prawn winced. At least if I no longer breathe, if my body stops functioning, there is hope of something more. Samnang waited. There is hope that I will find my sisters, my brother, my mother and father, my two sons, that we will rejoin and live again in another existence. Prawn swallowed. But if I choose your death, the death you were all living, then there is no hope. Samnang stood still. He felt a trickle of sweat flow from his forehead, down his cheek, and stop on his chin where it hung and would not fall. That is your confession. That is my confession, Prawn swallowed. Please kill me so that I may hope to live again in peace. Samnang wanted so badly to reach up and wipe that drop of sweat away. He wanted so badly to scratch his chin where the sweat clung, but he remained calm and smiled at Prawn. He turned to the note-taker, held out his hand. The note-taker handed him the piece of paper. Samnang looked it over as if studying a grocery list. He held it under Prawn's nose. Blood dripped on it. This is not a confession, Samnang said. He frowned. This is a direct attack on Anka. He folded it in half, then in half again. He put it in his pocket. Prawn whispered, That's all I have to say. You want to die then? That's what you wish? Prawn's words were labored and slurred. This is not a place for the living. Samnang ran his hand along the welts on Prawn's shoulders. It is a place for the guilty, the traitors. You say I'm guilty. You say everyone who resides here is guilty. Why then must I confess? Samnang stood in front of Pran, his hand stroking the back of Pran's head like a lover. "We want the names of others, where they hide, who is helping them. We want names." Fresh blood began to seep from beneath the crust on Pran's lips. He leaned forward as much as his shackles allowed so that it would drip on the floor instead of his chest. He quietly spat out a tooth as if it were a watermelon seed. "All my friends, all my family, everyone I know is dead. I have no names for you." People like to believe that there are always those who defy the system, who will stand up in defiance no matter what the cost. They relish the stories of heroes and martyrs who don't give in to evil. But not at S21. It didn't matter how strong they were, how willful. Here, they all gave in eventually. 25 years later, Samnang located Pran's official confession within a gray metal file cabinet and carried the bulky drawer that held it to a table set up for scholars and researchers. He remembered leading Pran along with 5 others to what used to be a playground, where once the shouts of children at play could be heard, was now filled with the sounds of heavy clubs landing on flesh and breaking bones, the subtle thud of emaciated and beaten bodies landing on hard-packed earth. Bullets were considered too expensive to waste on the executions. Pran died like the rest, body broken, soul crushed. He'd given a new confession outlining the lies the Central Party wanted to hear. Samnang now hovered over this confession. Blood marred it, bloody thumb and fingerprints, tiny neat drops spilled in random patterns. It attested to Pran's treason and guilt, the words of a dead man. "Give me back my soul." With his back to the lone guard standing watch over the room, Samnang pulled the other piece of paper from his pocket. "Is this what you want? Will this let you rest?" He replaced the official confession with Pran's original confession, folded up the official one and placed that in his shirt pocket. All too easy. He hefted the file drawer back into place and nodded at the guard. "I'm finished." He wiped away the seedlings of tears in his eyes. "Now perhaps I can sleep at night." Too easy. Would this truly let him sleep? He walked quickly down the corridors, past cells once used for education, then again for re-education. He exited into the courtyard in the center of the compound and heard the laughter and cries of children. The sun was high and hot. The children were dressed in black shirts and red scarves. Some of them looked up as he neared them. One caught a ball and held it against his chest. He motioned for Samnang to join them. They all stood watching Samnang, waiting. Samnang smiled at them. How long had it been since he played kickball? The one with the ball drew back and rolled the ball to Samnang. It rolled unevenly over the close-cropped grass. There was hair on the ball and tan, flesh-like protrusions. Ears, a nose, lips, eyes. It stopped at Samnang's feet. He did not kick it. He stood and stared. Here is Pran. This is Pran. Pran's lips contorted into a smile. As Samnang stared, gasping, he sensed the children walking slowly toward him. They whispered one word over and over. "Confess." A chorus of whispers. "Confess. Confess." Each of them pulled a plastic bag from their pockets. "Confess." Whispers that rose up into the wind. One after the other, they opened their bags. "Confess." They surrounded him. "Please." Samnang held up Pran's head. "I came here for him. That is all." A young boy came up to him. "Confess." The boy pulled the bag over Samnang's head. A girl ran up to him. "Confess!" She put her bag over his head. In quick succession, one after the other pulled their bags over Samnang's head. As his vision faded, it looked as if the playground opened up. He felt bony hands reach up and grab him, pulling. There is a story that the children visiting the Tool Slang Museum that day now tell their friends and family. They say a man picked up a soccer ball and held it in front of him. They say the man cried and talked to the ball and kissed it. They also say that the man turned blue and that he fell to the ground, tearing off the skin of his own face. The children are often asked, "But what happened to the man? Did you help him?" The children look away. How can they explain the pleasure, the rightness they felt, as they each took turns kicking the old man's body, beating it into the hard-packed soil? Or the museum guards who stood silently as they smoked hand-rolled cigarettes, their eyes black and dead like those in the photographs that lined the museum walls.
Ankar, by the way, is also a jealous of Spider. I have, it's safe to say, not been a fan of our eight-legged friends in the past for reasons ranging from the museum is a climbing frame to too many damn eyes and get it off me, get it off me, get it off me, oh god, my face, my face. Anyway, recently though, I found my attitude changing. Don't get me wrong, I'm not, nor will I be, investing in Barney the pet tarantula any freaking time soon, or indeed, whilst I live, but I've come to respect spiders, even admire them. England has some of the prettiest and charmingly non-lethal garden spiders you'll ever see, and the combination of industry and art, form and function, that goes into a spiderweb is difficult to ignore and impossible not to admire. They may be weird and crawly and have too many of pretty much everything. Oh, and that charming habit of eating their mate in some species following sex, but they're pretty much the Fonz, the Zaphod of the insect kingdom, if you will. It's a shame, then, that spiders have a different, far more negative connotation as well. After all, a spider sitting in the middle of its web is death waiting to strike. A deep, heavy engine of destruction that drags you into its orbit without you ever realizing it was there. It's the moment you realize it's far too late, the moment where you lose a game you didn't even know you were playing, the moment you hear skittering, sense movement, and know without a shadow of a doubt that there is nothing you can do. That spider, that's the spider of horror, the quiet, implacable alien death machine. That's the spider we stare in all eight eyes whenever we listen to, read, or watch horror. The spider that we choose to face down, to dare to look away first. The good news is, it does. The better news is that it's an imaginary spider that we can run from, defeat with love, or if necessary, kill using mind bullets, or daylight, or leaving all the lights on, or hide beneath the covers, because, as everyone knows, duvets are horror spider and axe murderer proof, and that, my friends, is a scientific fact. But no duvet on earth could protect you from me and my e-cap clutched in my e-hand. Oh yes, indeedy, it's public service announcement time. You see, we rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you, there is not an author on earth who doesn't experience a moment of pure, total, fierce joy when they are paid for something that they've pulled out of their own heads. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod had a dream like that once.